proceed, Ms. Lobo?
Yes.
This is case number 77529. Mr. Chen, are you also ready?
Yes.
Okay. All right, let's proceed. And who's accompanying you today, Ms. Lobo?
Mike Van Leven, who assisted me in this case.
Okay.
Some of the briefs.
Welcome.
All right, thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Good morning, Justices. My name is Adrienne Lobo, and I represent the petitioner DeAndre Gathright in this matter. Thank you for giving me the opportunity at oral argument to explain my position. May I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes.
The issue squarely before the court today is it permissible for a prosecutor to present evidence to a grand jury that has been previously ruled to be inadmissible pursuant to litigation in justice court? In other words, can the state evade a suppression ruling by simply presenting the suppressed evidence to the grand jury in a separate matter? The answer to this question simply must be no. The petitioner is asking this court to confirm and clearly state three following points that I will lay out. One is that the justice court order is indeed the law of the case, and it is binding on the court, the prosecutor, and the grand jury, unless and until it is overturned. And unless and until it is overturned, the suppressed evidence is inadmissible and cannot be presented to the grand jury. And the remedy in this case that petitioner is seeking for not appealing a suppression ruling under the prescribed statute of NRS 189.120 must be a dismissal of the indictment in this case. And in this case, a dismissal with prejudice, because the prosecution showed willful neglect and conscious indifference to the petitioner's due process rights under the Nevada and U.S. Supreme Court Constitution. So as to the matter of, is this the law of the case? The petitioner asserts that this indeed is the law of the case. The litigation began in justice court, and pursuant to the court's decision in Grace versus the 8th Judicial District Court, I filed a written motion and a pleading stating my reasons why, indeed, Mr. Gathright's rights had been violated pursuant to the Constitution. That matter came before the court, and it was tendered in advance 2 weeks before a preliminary hearing date. And when that hearing came, the state received an unfavorable ruling. And that unfavorable ruling essentially gutted the evidentiary universe of their case. The matter was not dismissed on that day because one witness still remained. And the essential witness that the state filed a Hill motion on did not show on the preliminary hearing date. A subsequent date was set 3 weeks later, and the witness again did not show. The state effectively dismissed pursuant to statute on that. We are asking this court to hold that stare decisis applies and that this is indeed the law of the case, given the fact that there was not a challenge under the prescribed statute of 189.120. The statute is clear and unambiguous in the matter that it is titled Appeal from a Suppression Order, and that there are two requirements that are outlined in terms of timing and when a proper appeal should be lodged with the district court. Those timing requirements are analogous and akin to 177.015 subpart 2 for an interlocutory appeal. To not file the appeal in this case effectively was tantamount to evading the suppression order. After the suppression order was on the record, the state had a variety of options, and they did not seek any of those options. They could have sought reconsideration in front of the justice court. They could have appealed under the prescribed statute, and they chose not to do that. And in choosing not to take advantage of that procedural right that they are entitled to and should have afforded them an opportunity at appeal, that worked to the detriment of Mr. Gathright.
Ms. Lobo, does the fact that in Grace, for instance, the court held justice courts have the inherent authority to mm-hmm. suppress illegally obtained evidence during preliminary hearings, is that significant? Does that speak to the reach of a justice court's finding? Is it only at preliminary hearings that finding has any resonance?
And that was indeed the language that was used in Grace. It was at a preliminary hearing, to be specific. However, when we look at NRS 189-120, and that was referenced in the court's decision, they explicitly laid out that there are timing requirements, 5 days from a ruling, 2 days from, or 2 days from a ruling if it is before a preliminary hearing, and 5 days if it is in tandem with the preliminary hearing. I'm asking this court and that the law be read as such that 189-120 is indeed something that the court should be considered and that the prosecution should have taken advantage of.
Well, if in fact the motion, there's a motion granted to suppress at a preliminary hearing stage.
Correct.
Whether before or at the preliminary hearing, and it's granted, but nonetheless defendant is held to answer. Is the state restricted in district court at all at trial in presenting that evidence, or does the defendant need to take further action?
Unless and until an appropriate challenge has been made, the preclusive effect is that it is binding on the court, the grand jury, and the district court, unless and until they take advantage of the prescribed remedy. That is the proposition that is before this court, and to hold otherwise would jeopardize the court's ruling and essentially the justice court's authority to hear suppression rulings. And in Grace, it was contemplated in footnote 4 that the court was not going to evaluate the issue of whether or not this is going to be applying to written motions. In this case, I filed the written motion in advance of the prelim because the issue was that glaring, and it turned out to be dispositive in this case. And if it was indeed an adverse ruling to the state of Nevada, that the prosecution should have taken advantage of that procedural rule that is afforded to them. And by not doing that, that worked to damage Mr. Gathright's due process rights. As far as it being separate cases,
is there any statute or case law that forbids or precludes the state from pursuing an indictment against your client?
There's nothing that expressly would forbid it. Exclusivity under State v. Mays is absolutely the holding in that case.
So what is the reasoning or authority that would compel a court to extend preclusive effect beyond what Grace says? Grace says that the suppressed evidence cannot be used in a preliminary hearing. It doesn't say that it is precluded for other purposes or in other circumstances.
That is correct.
So if the state wants to continue to pursue your client by way of a criminal complaint, it is doing so through that preliminary hearing process. If it felt that the suppression ruling was inappropriate, it can appeal that determination. If it overturns the appeal, it can continue to process the criminal complaint against your client. But I'm not sure that it has a preclusive effect on the district court's consideration of a subsequent indictment.
Well, and
so
if I may,
I'm a little bit concerned about how we analyze or develop a legal principle that connects the dots you want us to connect.
Well, and if I may address precisely that, and I understand mm-hmm. the court's concern, we're in a new area mm-hmm. of law. Under NRS 172-135, that is a statute that mandates that a prosecutor shall present legal evidence best in degree to the exclusion of hearsay. And logic and reason would dictate that if there is a prior ruling where a judicial officer has assessed the admissibility, the constitutionality of evidence, that now will be falling under 172-135. And absent a challenge that the state should not be allowed to go to the grand jury and misrepresent or have an opportunity to relitigate the issue under 189-120, as it's appropriately entitled an appeal, it's obviously that the appellate review would govern under 189-120. By seeking an indictment in front of the grand jury, we are now dealing with the sufficiency of the evidence and is a slighter marginal standard. It's the petitioner's assertion.
So what you're also suggesting is that if the state initiates a criminal complaint and the justice of the peace enters an adverse ruling to the state, the preclusive effect not only precludes the district court's consideration, but it also precludes the state's evidentiary presentation to the grand jury. Is there anything in the statutes, our statutes, that provides a basis for such a preclusive effect?
The conclusive effect is 189.120, and it's a procedural rule that impacts a defendant's due process rights. And until that challenge is made, they should be prohibited from presenting that evidence that has been deemed to be inadmissible.
If it was a robbery case and it was a confession, and the justice of the peace said the confession's not coming in, and the state ends up going to the grand jury a later date and just puts on the witnesses, this doesn't have any effect as long as they don't present the evidence that the justice of the peace has ruled on.
Correct. So I believe, yes, Justice Silver, that is what I am indeed saying, is that it wouldn't necessarily preclude it from all other evidence. There could be other independent evidence, but just the evidence, if it is deemed to be admissible by a justice court judge, that would indeed apply, and it would not be considered legal evidence as ruled upon and could not be presented under 172.135. And
so you're saying that the grand jury, that characterization by the justice court as not legal, meaning violated constitutional rights, whether it relates to a confession or a piece of evidence.
Correct.
Should be given effect under the grand jury rule for legal evidence.
Correct.
But you agree it wouldn't have any other effect going forward. It's just what they could or could not present at the grand jury, which requires that it all be legal evidence. Because when they went to district court, let's say it's a gun, could they introduce the gun in district court?
Right, unless and until it has been, some sort of challenge has been made, that they are precluded. And if they choose to present that illegal evidence, there might be a situation, it's certainly not the facts of this case, but there might be another situation where the evidence that was suppressed is not presented, or possibly it's outweighed with other evidence that is untainted.
What if, isn't it grand jury a all new proceeding? So if it's a start of a whole new proceeding and you have the indictment, why wouldn't that district court then be in charge of whatever constitutional rights were involved at the grand jury there? Why isn't it anew?
Okay, so I'm going to take those one at a time. One of the issues that you raised is, absolutely, is it a separate indictment? Yes, it is a separate charging instrument. However, only if it is kept separate. And once you receive an unfavorable ruling and you don't make your challenge under the procedural rule, then you go to the grand jury for take two. It's impermissible in the way it was used in this case. What essentially was done was a presentation based on inadmissible evidence to gain jurisdiction with the district court under a slight or marginal evidence sufficiency standard. The writ that I filed addressed squarely that issue about the sufficiency and the durability of the justice court's ruling in this case. It did not open up and attempt to relitigate it. In essence, what happened is that the state's, I believe, return and also their opposition reproffered the issue and essentially had this second bite to relitigate it now under a sufficiency of the evidence standard versus an appellate review that would have been proper under the prescribed remedy. And it would be impermissible and untenable for, if you're in one arena, you're winning in a baseball game, you're up, you're ahead, and then you move to another field and continue the second and third inning. And what happened here was a detriment to my client's due process rights. Due process in itself.
Well, I get, we've heard your argument on the preclusive effect, but there is another part of your argument I'd like you to address, and we're beating into the time, so maybe you can address this during rebuttal.
Okay.
but I'd like Mr. Chin to address it as well. And it has to do with, apart from the preclusive effect argument, if the court were to reject that, if this panel rejected that argument, you made another argument, I thought, which was that the state, under its duties to the grand jury, had an obligation to present exculpatory evidence, and that a justice of the peace's determination that the gun evidence should have been suppressed should have been presented to the grand jury. Think about that, and we'll ask Mr. Chin to address it.
All right.
All right.
Thank
you. Go ahead, Mr. Chin. We'll add 2 minutes to your time, and we ate into Ms. Lovell's rebuttal time. She'll have 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, Justices. My name is Alexander Chan. I represent the state of Nevada respondent in this particular matter. I also was the team chief of the deputy who was handling this case, and we had conversations about this case. So although I was not the prosecuting attorney at the time, the decisions that were made ultimately were mine, and I stand behind those decisions because I do believe that they're in line with not only Nevada case law, but with the statutes that we have as well. What this appellant is asking this court to do is to basically rewrite the legislative intent, rewrite the statutes of the state of Nevada. There are very specific statutes that relate to the justice court. There are very specific statutes that relate to the grand jury. And this court historically has not written additional elements into the requirements presented in NRS 172, for instance, regarding presentation of grand juries. Now, on a practical level, I understand the frustration here. There's no question that Judge Goodman, in this case, found that evidence was going to be suppressed. And I understand that not only the appellant in this matter, but NACJ also wrote a brief on it. And of course, they want an opportunity to cross-examine. I would argue that most of the time, defense counsel wants an opportunity to cross-examine witnesses at a preliminary hearing and is upset if the state takes it to the grand jury. But the fact of the matter is, the state of Nevada has set up these two mechanisms, two separate mechanisms, the justice court and one run by the district court, which is the grand jury, in order for the state to establish probable cause and to present our cases.
Mr. Chan, at the time that Judge Goodman granted the motion to suppress, would you characterize that piece of evidence as legal or not legal?
At that time? In terms of the suppression issue. If it would have gone before the Justice of the Peace, Your Honor, no, I would not.
So you'd say it's not legal?
In front of that Justice of the Peace, absolutely, because the judge made a ruling whether I agree or not. Now, with regards to that, in fact, Justice Stiglitz, this court, every justice supported it at the time when it decided Grace, said that there is a limited inherent authority for the Justice of the Peace to make suppression issues. So we understand that, right? But what didn't happen there was, contrary to many of the cases like Rincon and others that deal with hearings before a trial court, there were no findings of fact. There was no evidentiary hearing. So although Grace said, absolutely, the Justice of the Peace is allowed to consider legal evidence and allowed to decide motions to suppress, here we didn't have any type of actual hearing. Judge Goodman thought that it was unnecessary despite the request from our deputy to have the hearing on the matter. And when we had the hearing in front of Judge Herndon, Judge Herndon came to a very different legal conclusion. And I think that's relevant. And not only that, in Grace, when the court is talking about this limited inherent authority that's put forth in Grace, they cite the legislative history. And they talk about the fact that oftentimes the practical function of the attorneys when they go to a preliminary hearing is it also serves as somewhat of an evidentiary hearing. So you don't need to have two hearings. You don't need to have an evidentiary hearing, and then you need to have a preliminary hearing, that they can serve as both. And the questions can be asked of whether that evidence is legal or not. What I would also say, though, is I know appellant has cited NRS 189.120 regarding the appeal, the state's appeal of a justice of the peace's decision. Again, that refers, in our opinion, to the actual language in that statute, which is only limited to preliminary hearings, that it doesn't affect the district court. And I can tell you, mm-hmm. Do you have a question? Sorry,
I'm sorry, did I have that face on? It's a unique situation? Because typically a grand jury can happen before any judges have gotten their hands in it.
Sure.
And it would seem that to some extent, well, I'd ask you, are we reading more into the grand jury prescription that says only legal evidence? It doesn't say only legal evidence with any other limitation. And we know that after Judge Goodman's ruling, that piece of evidence at that snapshot in time was not legal evidence. So can we read these all in harmony and say, hey, it's a rule of evidence at the grand jury. It has to be legal evidence. And until that label has been removed from that piece of evidence, it's illegal for presentation to the grand jury.
I think that would be reading beyond the statutes as they are and beyond the cases that this court has had on prior decisions related to exculpatory evidence, Schuster and Mays, and a number of other cases that this court has decided where, despite the objections of the defense in those cases, this court has said you don't have absolute right to discovery, you don't have absolute right to an attorney, because, and specifically in those decisions, it references the fact that the court was not going to re-legislate what the legislature had already made in its statute of NRS 172. It wasn't going to add additional elements. And I do believe that if you were to do that, you would be adding elements to NRS 172, which don't exist. With regards to the, and I think one of the questions Justice Hardesty was asking about was related to the exculpatory evidence and kind of what the state's obligations were there. From the way that I see it, the legal evidence that's referred to is more of evidentiary nature. Certainly, here in the state of Nevada, as opposed to, say, federal court, we're limited in terms of the type of evidence we can put forth before our grand juries. We're not allowed to use hearsay unless there's an exception to the hearsay rule. Obviously, the state agrees with that and would not present evidence of hearsay, for instance, at a grand jury presentment because it would be illegal. But that would be our reading of it, is that it, certainly Judge Goodman was entitled to his opinion despite the fact that he didn't have for this hearing. But I would say, just like in the Harrington case, which we cited, that's a simple legal opinion. In Harrington, the entire issue was whether a judgment of conviction for a DUI third offense was going to be considered by the Justice of the Peace. And that Justice of the Peace, for whatever reason, decided they were not going to allow that. So the state simply went before a grand jury. They didn't appeal it under NRS 189.120. They went to a grand jury and found a method through the grand jury to present the judgment's conviction, and the case went to district court. Now, of course, at that point, there's nothing that prohibits appellant or any defendant who's charged with a crime with relitigating the issue, with seeking recourse from the district court, which happened in this case as well. Motions were filed to dismiss, motions were filed to suppress, and that's why Judge Herndon ultimately had an evidentiary hearing in which he determined that this evidence shouldn't have been suppressed. And Justice Stiglitz, I think with regards to your prior point, I think that's the danger of putting so much weight in one Justice of the Peace's legal opinion, because what if it's wrong? You would say that the only remedy is that the state would have to seek the district court to then reverse that Justice of the Peace, and then the case could proceed forward. And I think that would really be extending the statutes beyond their beyond what is prescribed.
So your contention, Mr. Chen, is that this court has effectively defined the term legal evidence in the statute in other cases, and that that definition anticipates or allows for the presentation of evidence suppressed in another proceeding?
I would say that, no, Justice Hardesty, that there has been no specific ruling that I'm aware of that explains it.
So I wasn't either, and I didn't see it. Yes. The reason I'm asking you this question is, what case or what rule in a case are you pointing to that allows the court to analogize or extend that ruling to cover this incident? Do you follow my question?
So you're asking if there's a case that would support my proposition there. Okay. What I would say, Justice Hardesty, is no, there is no case in which you have where the court has defined what that legal evidence is. However, I do believe that there are many cases, Schuster, Mayo versus 8th District Court, and others that have reached similar decisions regarding exculpatory evidence and what is considered exculpatory and what the state needs to do. In Schuster, for example, this court had to determine whether the state was going to give, was mandated to give self-defense instructions before a grand jury, whether we had to actually instruct them. And the court said, we're not going to rewrite the statute as it exists.
But there does seem to be a little bit of a difference between requiring the state to give certain instructions on the law versus the statutory sure. statement about what is meant by legal evidence. It's, you know, it, frankly, it's kind of an odd phrase in any statute, but we got a lot of statutes sure. with odd phrases in them. Is there any other source that you would direct the court to, legislative history, cases, states that have other language in their grand jury presentments or proceedings that would help guide the court with respect to the use of the term legal evidence?
I don't know that.
Looking for a statutory interpretation, that wasn't really very well developed that I could see. So normally we begin with the usual rules of statutory construction when confronted with a problem like this.
Correct. And again, I'm not familiar with one that defines the specific thing, which I assume is in part why we're here today to argue this, Justice. Though I would say that
both counsel have identified why we're here to argue, that's for sure.
I would say this, Justice. I think it's important for this court to remember as well that some of the rights put forth for defendants or those accused at a grand jury are statutory in nature, and that includes the idea that exculpatory evidence must be presented before a grand jury. In fact, in Schuster, which cites
so
Williams...
That takes me to the question sure. that I posited to your opponent. Was the existence of a ruling by a justice court suppressing the evidence, evidence that was exculpatory that at least the grand jury needed to learn about?
I don't believe so, because exculpatory
is
explain away the charge, Your Honor. In this case, had that rule of law been true, say, in district court, and the district court had suppressed our evidence, and we didn't have Raymond Moore, who was the witness who didn't show up, to testify to the things that we're asking for, we would have lost. I mean, we simply would have lost it.
I get the district court proceedings and, right. and Judge Herndon's approach here. What we're talking about is the vehicle to get the district court.
I understand.
You know, I mean,
my point, Justice...
I think the state has a point that these are separate vehicles to get to district court. But the vehicle you have chosen has some rules surrounding it. So are those rules impacted at all by evidentiary rulings made in the other proceeding? That's really the fundamental problem here.
Justice, I think in our brief, we also talked about not just this. This is a big one. A motion to suppress is probably a bigger thing. But I'd say that we talk about any evidentiary ruling, leading questions that may get sustained. You have relevance objections that may be sustained. You have hearsay objections that may or may not be sustained. I don't think it would be safe to make those evidentiary rulings law of the case, and that somehow, unless some, for instance, relevant
objection...
I'm not
suggesting that it's law of the case. I understand Ms. Lovell's argument. I'm not sure that there... But there's a different argument from preclusive effect to whether or not its evidentiary value has changed or its evidentiary admissibility has changed as a result of the Justice Court's ruling.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I think all I can say with regards to that is, citing back to Harrington, Your Honor, that it's a legal opinion, and certainly that's one individual Justice mm-hmm. of the Peace's legal opinion on that time based upon the information that he made his ruling. But I think that's the dangerous effect of expanding it beyond what the statute is and what the statutes prescribe. And one of the things I was going to point out with regards to the statutory construction that the court was asking about is that, as I mentioned, all of these protections are not due process protections, they're statutory protections that have been interpreted by the court.
Well, that's why the issue of statutory construction And that analysis, to me, is kind of a missing piece in this argument.
Mr. Chen, if the matter had proceeded to district court,
yes,
let's say, and the district court judge found a piece of evidence inadmissible,
yes,
and then the state went to grand jury to add additional charges, could the state use that piece of evidence at the grand jury?
I think that would be a very different situation.
Why?
Because it's a district court, for one. The district court is responsible, not for the grand juries, by statute, as well as, ultimately, that's where that case is going to go. It's going to go to that district court, who obviously has already made an evidentiary ruling that certain evidence would be inadmissible. So I think it...
Why wouldn't your duty be to appeal that district court judge's ruling to the Supreme Court? Because they're not the end all, if you start in district court. And likewise in justice court. If you're starting in justice court, why isn't the district court the appellate court, and why don't you appeal that? I mean, isn't that the same argument, what we're talking about?
I think in the district court, you provide 174.085, which provides for the remedy of the state to appeal to a higher court.
Here.
But that's a district court, and I think that's very distinguishable.
We just talked about you going to the... The district court makes a ruling,
sure,
suppression. You just said you could go back to the grand jury.
I said that would be wrong. Yeah.
Without going to the Supreme Court.
Correct. Exactly.
But yet in justice court, you think you can go to the grand jury without appealing it to the district court.
Correct, Your Honor. And I can tell you also why it's different in this particular case. Because there were two charges in this case. You have the appellant who was charged with the murder charge, and then you have the ex-felon in possession. And the ex-felon in possession based on assault with a deadly weapon and discharging of a firearm. That was the concern. Now, there were issues, and the record supports the fact that the defendant in this statement as well says that this is a self-defense type of case, that the gun was pulled out, and that's one of the reasons that he shot him. It wasn't until we had the other witness, Raymond Moore, who was going to be able to testify to who started the shooting, as well as who was possessing the gun, which in this case it would have been appellant. So had we stuck with the preliminary hearing, had Mr. Moore made himself or responded to his subpoenas, we would have been able to get to district court based upon his expected testimony. So that's part of the reason why no appeal was filed here, is because we could have shown it with that evidence. Now I understand ultimately he didn't show up twice, and we voluntarily dismissed the case pursuant to NRS 174.085. But because of the way that we construed the statute, we went to the grand jury and expected and fully expected that appellant at that point would file a motion to suppress based upon the same issue at the justice court. And obviously,
it's kind of similar to the Warren case, too. I mean, but in the Warren case, the state appealed to the district court.
I certainly feel that an appeal is a remedy that the state could have sought, and obviously it's in statute for us to do that under NRS 189. But in this particular case, given the facts and the circumstances of it, we went to the grand jury, and it's our position that the statutes permitted that, and that it wasn't that Justice Goodman's, or Judge Goodman, I'm sorry, his ruling was simply a legal opinion.
May I ask one quick question?
Sure, of course.
Not to belabor in separate issue. Did you think it was proper for Judge Herndon at the motion to dismiss to sua sponte turn that into a relitigation of the suppression motion? Because that nobody filed a motion to revisit the motion to suppress. It was whether or not there was legal binding, you know, effect on this.
Right.
And then he decided to litigate the propriety of the suppression. Did you think that was proper?
I do, because ultimately I think that's where we were headed. And I think Judge Herndon didn't outright dismiss the case because Judge Herndon didn't feel that the state had done anything wrong in going to the grand jury and seeking an indictment. So I think he performed his function as a district court judge to determine what the evidentiary value of our case was.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chin. You have 2 minutes, Ms. Lobo.
Okay.
let me be clear with what our position is. Is that, one, it is the law of the case. Two, is that we do qualify under 172.135 subpart 2. The inadmissible evidence does retain its character, and the constitutional challenge remains the same. There was not... It remains the same no matter what venue you are indeed in.
So this is a statutory interpretation question. What is the meaning of the term legal evidence in the statute you cited?
Right. And within the plain meaning of the statute, legal evidence is evidence that obviously would be permissible for a grand jury to hear. And a threshold analysis of that is that a judicial officer who's sworn to uphold the laws and the Constitution has deemed it to be illegal. So I would like to draw a distinction, at least with Sheriff Dave Harrington, because I know that that is one of the main issues that was raised by the respondent. So in Sheriff Dave Harrington, it was characterized as a legal opinion. And in that case, the court's ruling was very limited in the nature about whether or not it was exculpatory and whether or not the constitutional infirmity of the prior conviction was exculpatory. That is not the primary argument that we're proffering as the petitioner before this court, is that it should not have even happened and that it would fall under the classification of 172.135 as legal evidence. And to that end, it is distinguishable factually. I think that we need to point out here that Harrington dealt with a situation where it was dealing with penalty versus here we're dealing with the actual elements of the crime. So that's a sub-argument that I think that the court can consider and accord it whatever authority it may.
All right. Thanks, Ms. Lowe. Any other questions for counsel?
No, sir.
All right. Thank you.